Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming to this nighttime lecture. Thanks for voting yesterday. Today I'm going to talk to you about systemic and localized scleroderma, and please let me know if you have questions. All right? So as you probably know, scleroderma, otherwise known as systemic sclerosis, is a chronic disease that causes skin thickening and tightening and can involve fibrosis and other types of damage to internal body organs. It's thought to be autoimmune disease, affects both adults and children, most commonly adult women. And while as of now, effective treatments are available for some of the manifestations of this disease, scleroderma is not yet curable. So systemic sclerosis is uncommon. I probably have 5 or 6 patients in my personal panel. There's a couple others in the rheumatology fellows panel. Only 200 to 300 per million in the US are affected. Traditional DMARDs, like our medications for lupus and RA, are not really that effective for treatment. And increasingly, different aspects of scleroderma are becoming treatable, and I'll show you as we're elucidating more of the pathogenesis, we're hoping to target the pathways that way. So as you know, it's characterized by vascular changes, intimal proliferation leading to deposition of collagen and fibrosis. The presentation and progression is variable from patient to patient. And again, just as a reminder, there's really no effective treatment. There's no list of medications that work for scleroderma. Certain things work for different patients. We typically tailor to whichever organ manifestations the patient has. Scleroderma is more than one syndrome. There's localized scleroderma or morphea, which is confined to the skin or subcutaneous tissues. And there's multiple clinical variants, and I'll go through those with you so you'll be able to recognize them in your patients. And then there's systemic sclerosis, whether it's limited, diffuse, or an overlap syndrome with other connective tissue diseases. That's more uniform skin involvement and also potential for internal organ involvement, and it's a more severe pattern of disease. And the CREST variant is what you probably know about, which is actually the limited systemic sclerosis. We try to stay away from CREST just because those are not the only features of that disease process, but it's often used that term. So localized scleroderma. Each of the forms of localized scleroderma is a skin disorder, and it sometimes goes to the deeper tissues. The most visible effects are skin lesions referred to as morphea. And it can be differentiated from the systemic sclerosis by the distribution. Okay, there's typically no sclerodactyly, there's no perioral involvement. Patients don't usually have Raynaud's, they may not have periungual telangiectasias like the scleroderma disease patients will have. And very rare is organ involvement a part of the process. The age is usually younger than scleroderma patients, usually 20 to 40. Linear morphea, which I'll show you a picture of, usually affects pediatric patients, and the deep morphea, usually around the 40s and 50s. So a typical morphea lesion usually begins as a patch of erythema or edema, and there may be an associated purplish border. The primary lesion is hyperpigmented patches, which can sometimes be confused with, you know, an allergy, a rash, maybe a psoriasis type picture. But these lesions become progressively indurated and then eventually have a porcelain white or yellow hue. And after they resolve, there's atrophy, depigmentation, or hyperpigmentation. So this is what I was referring to. Okay, so plaque morphea involves the dermis and occasionally the superficial panniculus. The trunk is generally more commonly involved than the extremities, although the face, neck, and scalp can also be involved. And plaque morphea comprises more than half of the cases. And like I said, once again, this is just the limited scleroderma, just the dermatologic manifestations. Patients who have this usually don't have organ involvement. So another type of morphea is called gutta morphea. This usually occurs in the upper trunk, typically presents as multiple oval lesions between 2 and 10 millimeters. They often manifest as faint erythema and then get indurated or hypopigmented later on. And there's also keloid morphea, which presents as nodules that resemble keloids in the presence of typical morphea. So I don't know if any of these descriptions are ringing bells in you and some of your patients who have, you know, strange funky skin lesions that you send to the dermatologist, but it may actually be the dermatologic manifestation of scleroderma. There's also lichen sclerosis, which is shiny white plaques, often preceded by a violaceous discoloration of the skin, and typically falls in the anogenital area. And then lastly, the atrophoderma of Pessini and Pierni, which is asymptomatic, hyperpigmented atrophic plaques with well-demarcated cliff drop borders on the trunk. Okay. So localized scleroderma, including deep and extensive lesions, can prevent normal motion. So patients may be contracted just because their skin is so thickened by these lesions. And it may actually really interfere with their daily activities. So, you know, once it becomes indurated, they just have a real immobility of movement, and they may either misinterpret that as a joint problem or as pain, but it's really limiting. But it, once again, just as a reminder, it doesn't affect the internal organs. So generalized morphea or linear scleroderma actually is more widespread. It causes more thickness and scarring. And these lesions can go to the fat, muscle, and occasionally bone. So this is much more deforming and more serious, where individual plaques of the morphea coalesce to become confluent lesions. It can affect more than two sites, including the upper body, the abdomen, upper thighs, and you know, basically the entire body surface area can be involved. And once again, contractures can occur, especially if the lesions become confluent. So linear scleroderma, this is more commonly seen in the pediatric rheumatology clinics, where you have a linear streak causing deformity. Okay, so one or more linear streaks in induration that can involve the dermis, subcutaneous tissue, muscle, or bone, occurring on the extremities, the face, or scalp of children and adolescents. It's more than, in more than 90% of cases, it's unilateral. And like you see here, it can be complicated by deformities, joint contractures, and really severe limb atrophy. So this is another lesion of linear scleroderma on the scalp. And these are called the uncoupe de sabre. I don't know if anyone's seen or heard of this before, but essentially it's supposed to be like the stroke of a sword from a saber. And lesions can start with contractions and firmness, and they actually can progress and eventually, in very severe cases, in untreated cases, that can cause progressive hemifacial atrophy, really where there's atrophy of the face. The lesions occur in the subcutaneous tissue, muscle, and bone. And this is usually in children less than 2 years old, so it's really important to sort of diagnose it early. Okay, now deep morphea, this is just, you know, continued progression of the limited scleroderma, where it's lesions more diffuse than linear scleroderma, whether it's subcutaneous or morphea profunda. Okay, and I just wanted you to be familiar with the fact that the word scleroderma is really a broad topic, and you know, all of these different lesions can present in both the pediatric and adult population, so you really may be diagnosing these before patients get to us, because they don't usually have Raynaud's and they don't usually have arthritis. Okay, and these are some of the deeper tissue lesions. Okay, so this diagnosis is based on clinical findings, although a biopsy is often needed to exclude other disorders, maybe like a toxic exposure. Sometimes patients think, oh, you know, well, I was, you know, cleaning my garage with, you know, new solvent, maybe that's what it was, you know. So those are the cases where possibly a biopsy would help. Patients may have a high EOS count in linear scleroderma, and they also may have hyperglycoglobulinemia. As far as autoantibodies in this population of the limited scleroderma, most of them will have, you know, it's possible that they have an ANA or an anti-single-stranded DNA antibody or anti-histone antibodies. If these patients do have a positive rheumatoid factor that may predict articular involvement, whether it's based on the contractures, they may eventually develop myalgias. And typically, the antibodies that are seen in the diffuse and limited systemic sclerosis are not often seen in these cases. Progression to systemic sclerosis is very rare, but there can be arthralgias. Patients can also, you know, in other case reports, there have been patients with synovitis or uveitis, but it is very rare, and it's usually not a big concern. Okay, and this is just to show you that there really is a very long list of possible treatments for these diseases, but they're, you know, not typically very effective. Okay, so systemic sclerosis, this is more of what you'll be seeing and treating. The diffuse systemic sclerosis can affect the skin in almost the entire body area. The fibrosis usually starts proximal to the elbows and knees. These patients typically have a rapid disease progress. You know, typically, you know, within the first year of developing Raynaud's, they will develop the other manifestations of scleroderma. More likely to have pulmonary fibrosis, GI involvement, kidney or heart involvement than patients who have a limited systemic sclerosis. They are the patients who will have a positive ANA and the anti-SEL70 antibody. And the, you know, the disease course is variable depending on the patient and also depending on the doctor and their readiness to seek care. But overall, it's a relatively poor prognosis. And this goes back to the fact that it's one, very rapidly progressive, and two, that the treatments are really not that effective.
How specific is the scleroderma 70? In other words, if it's negative, do you exclude the diagnosis?
No. I mean,
what percentage of patients will it be negative?
What percent will it be negative? I would say probably about 30% won't have it. But you definitely don't rule it out if the patient has all the other features of disease. Okay, so limited systemic sclerosis is a little bit more milder disease, more slowly progressing. The skin involvement would usually be limited to the forearms, hands, legs, feet, and face. These are the patients who usually have Raynaud's for years, maybe even for years before they come to the attention of a rheumatologist to get to this diagnosis. If they do have visceral disease, it's later on, but hypertension and pulmonary hypertension specifically are the more prominent features. Once again, this is the CREST subgroup. These patients have an anti-centromere antibody, and they do have a relatively good prognosis with greater than 70% survival at 10 years compared to the 40 to 60% at 10 years in the diffuse group. There's also a subgroup of scleroderma patients that actually have an overlap syndrome. They may have diffuse or limited systemic sclerosis overlapping with lupus, with myositis, and also the mixed connective tissue disease, where patients have features of a couple of these diagnoses, not enough to meet criteria for one, but they have a positive RMP, and they have the Raynaud's and interstitial lung disease. So this systemic sclerosis involves the pathologic remodeling of connective tissues, and that leads to all the problems that patients have. The cardinal problems are excess of collagen production and deposition with vascular damage and inflammation. There is widespread small vessel vasculopathy and fibrosis, and it's in the setting of immune system activation. And the vascular injury affects small arteries, arterioles, and capillaries. And it's probably, you know, primarily for these reasons that our typical DMARDs, which are immune suppressive, you know, to treat rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, it's probably why these are not that effective in this disease, because the endpoint is a different process with the fibrosis and the collagen deposition that's different from all the ongoing inflammation and active cell deposition in our other diseases. This is just to illustrate to you a little bit about the pathogenesis, where it's initiated by a vascular injury leading to endothelial cell activation and all of the inflammatory cell components getting activated, leading to inflammation and autoimmunity, and eventually the fibroblasts basically are ongoingly active. It's uncontrolled fibroblast deposition and collagen deposition leading to the fibrosis. Okay, so genetics likely predispose patients. You know, like I said, like a lot of our other diseases, we don't exactly know why this happens, but we think genetics is a part of it. It's probably the result of a combination of, you know, being a candidate for it and then having some type of environmental exposure, which leads to that whole process happening. There is some data suggesting that exposure to solvents or environmental agent may be part of the cause. There's also scleroderma-like syndromes that have been linked to particular solvents, particular fertilizers or these chlorides and contaminants of tryptophan. But the majority of patients do not say that they have an exposure history. So who's going to be your patients with scleroderma? Like I said before, it's very rare. Only up to 100,000 people in the U.S. currently have scleroderma. How many people in this group have actually had a patient in their clinic with scleroderma? All right, it's a big fat zero. So See, I only have five and have seen a few in the hospital with you probably, but it's really not that common, especially compared to our other diseases. 70% of the patients are women, usually diagnosed in the 30 to 50 year range. Twins and family members have more patients who have other connective tissue disease or autoimmune disease appear to be at a slightly increased risk, which is what we say about all of our diseases. But if you ask most patients with scleroderma if there is anyone in their family who has lupus or RA, usually the answer is no. Children can get scleroderma, although the pattern may be different. Like I was showing you, most of those limited versions of the skin manifestations are seen in the pediatric population more than the diffuse or limited systemic sclerosis. Progressive interstitial pulmonary fibrosis is less frequent and with better survival in the Caucasian population. They also have an increased rate of the anti-shunt chimeric antibody, whereas African Americans have an increased rate of the SCL70 antibody, which we think is more pathogenic and more connected, again, to the more rapidly progressive diffuse disease. So the classification criteria for systemic sclerosis include proximal scleroderma, like I was telling you, proximal to the elbows, sclerodactyly, digital pitting or scars. They may have basilar pulmonary fibrosis. Patients will typically have thickened skin, and again, it's an abnormal production of collagen by fibroblasts, accumulation of glycosaminoglycans and fibronectin, and essentially, you know, you'll see it beginning in the fingers and hands. It just really just gets thick, and they really can't extend their digits whatsoever. They may have calcinosis or telangiectasias, whether it's in the digits or on the face. And telangiectasias is the part, that T part of the Kress syndrome. It's more common in limited systemic sclerosis. And these telangiectasias can also appear in the GI tract. That's what's important to remember. So, you know, every patient with scleroderma needs to have an annual guaiac, stool guaiac, you know, just to check to make sure that they're not slowly bleeding, and that's an important part of the disease process as well. Okay, so this is some of the digital lesions with the calcinosis and telangiectasias on the face. Once again, the Kress variant, which includes calcinosis, Raynaud's, esophageal dysfunction, sclerodactyly, and telangiectasias. Another part of the clinical features that you've probably seen is Raynaud's. People in this room have seen patients with Raynaud's? Yeah, okay. That was two, good. Almost about 90% of people with scleroderma also have Raynaud's, but obviously the reverse doesn't fit. And as you know, Raynaud's is, it's a three-phase effect. It can affect the hands and feet, the nose, the ears, and the tongue. You know, so these may be important questions to ask patients who come in complaining of symptoms that sound like Raynaud's, and when you're trying to decide whether or not you need to send the autoantibody profile. You know, I would say anyone who does complain of Raynaud's, you should be sending the autoantibody profile. You should be doing a nail fold capillary assessment. But, you know, in particular, if they really have it in their hands and feet and on the face, then that's, you know, a clear picture of what Raynaud's is. Patients may eventually progress to ischemic necrosis of the digits. They may ulcerate and become infected. I have a lot of difficulty for some reason getting these patients to take the medication until they come in with a necrotic digit once the weather changes, and then they're in real trouble. And like I was mentioning about the capillary, on microscopic examination in Raynaud's, in people who've had it for some duration, or in people who are more likely to have the diffuse form, when you first examine them, it's possible that they may have dropout of the capillaries of the vessels. So primary Raynaud's, just to distinguish between primary and secondary Raynaud's, primary Raynaud's may actually be more of a female predominance, much like most of our diseases anyway, onset at menarche, all digits involved, multiple attacks daily, triggered by emotion and cold. They typically don't have ischemic ulcers, and they usually also have normal nail fold capillaries. Okay, and these are patients who are much less likely to have any of the systemic features of scleroderma, as opposed to secondary Raynaud's patients who may have a later onset. It may involve only a few digits at a time. Typically, ischemic ulcers may be present. They may also have edema. They may really, you know, have that skin tightening or periuncal capillaries abnormal and systemic features, and also a positive ANA. And this is just to show you there is a really long list of conditions associated with secondary Raynaud's. We see it a lot in our lupus patients, often in the mixed connective tissue disease population as well. So it's not always scleroderma, but if it is scleroderma, it's important to know. So if a patient that you see in clinic has Raynaud's, they may be that person who's going to progress to systemic disease if they have a positive ANA with the subserologies, if their nail fold capillary exam is abnormal, if they have tendon friction rubs, if they have puffy or swollen fingers, if they also have GERD, and I know that's a hard one because it seems like most of the patients in clinic are on an H2 blocker or PPI for symptoms of GERD, but these are people who really just need to be looked into further. And also, if the Raynaud's is within, if the Raynaud's precedes skin changes by more than a year, they are likely to have that slower, progressive, limited course of disease, you know, more of the crest variant. But if the Raynaud's and they have skin changes all at the same time, then they're probably, unfortunately, going to have the diffuse systemic sclerosis. I mean, this is just to show you where it's really not all of the digits, but it's just a point in time where, you know, these are going from one phase to the next. Fortunately, this patient didn't have digital ulcers just yet, but this one did. And you can see they're pretty subtle, and sometimes they look like vasculitis lesions. But again, you know, they really can progress to ulcerate and become infected. And this was just a picture just to illustrate what the nail fold capillary beds might look like. I mean, it's definitely not the easiest exam to do, you know, where you're putting the gel on the fingernail and using the ophthalmoscope, but once you've seen it a couple of times, you'll probably get more used to testing for it. How do you treat Raynaud's? You probably all know about this. There's non-pharmacologic treatments. You know, tell people if they're a smoker to stop smoking, avoid beta blockers, exercise, keep warm, wear gloves, the use of calcium channel blockers, or angiotensin receptor antagonists. You know, there's topical nitro that we use oftentimes, especially if people are starting to ulcerate. Digital sympathectomy is another one of the treatments that's recommended. I've only seen a couple of patients do well with that, and it's not commonly very effective, but it is one of the treatments out there. So the GI tract is the second most common affected organ system, second to the skin. 70 to 90% of patients actually have it. They may have lower esophageal dysmotility, or they have smooth muscle fibrosis. 80% of patients will have GERD. They have fibrosis and stricture formation. They may develop aspiration pneumonias because of this. Patients also are at risk for gastroparesis and for the telangiectasias I was mentioning to you earlier. They may have malabsorption and diarrhea, secondary to bacterial overgrowth, and they can eventually develop an ileus. So this can be a pretty serious problem. They may get severe constipation, megacolon, and this is just to show you the stricture and some lower GI tract involvement. So, you know, the typical treatment, like you tell your other GERD patients, you know, elevate the head of the bed, put patients on PPI. They may also benefit from prokinetic drugs, whether erythromycin, just to promote motility of the upper tract. Usually, if they have a stricture at the time of the exam, they will require dilatation. And the bleeding telangiectasias really need to be treated because otherwise the patients can bleed out. A lot of these patients end up being placed on Coumadin for their pulmonary hypertension. So if they're on Coumadin and they're at risk for a telangiectasia in their GI tract, that's potential disaster. In the lower tract, the symptoms related to bacterial overgrowth may improve with courses of antibiotics. They also may be given prokinetic agents from the gastroenterologist, octreotide. Rarely they need to be placed on TPN actually at the end of the course of their disease because they really just don't have a functional GI tract. It's all fibrotic and the muscle tissue is just not functioning. Okay, so pulmonary disease and systemic sclerosis can range from the vasculature to the lung tissue itself. Patients may have interstitial fibrosis, pulmonary hypertension. They, like I said before, they're at risk for aspiration pneumonia. They can also get pleural disease. There is some increased risk of lung cancer. And it's most commonly initial respiratory symptom is dyspnea on exertion without a cough or chest pain. So these are patients who, you know, have a slow progressive course and you know, they eventually have dyspnea on exertion. pulmonary manifestations of systemic sclerosis occur in more than 70% of patients, and it's the most common cause of morbidity and mortality. Pulmonary fibrosis is a common cause of severe restrictive lung disease in general, and the chest x-ray will show interstitial thickening or reticular pattern, and the high-res CT will show ground glass if there is ongoing inflammation. They may also have bronchiectasis, and they also, this is a disease of fibrosis, so if you catch them at the point where they're already dyspneic, most likely you'll find honeycombing and fibrosis in the CAT scan of the chest. The patients will have restrictive disease on pulmonary function tests. Somewhat later, they may have bibasal rails. And some patients with ILD develop slowly progressive respiratory failure over 2 to 10 years, especially those with the anti-SCL70 antibody, which is also this anti-topoisomerase 1 antibody. In diffuse systemic sclerosis, the interstitial lung disease is more common, whereas in the limited or CREST version, the pulmonary hypertension is more common. But both can occur in both populations. It's just not very common if a patient has the limited scleroderma that they have either of those two. Okay. So pulmonary hypertension, it's more common than previously thought. It's noted in up to a third of patients and can occur early. Signs of pulmonary hypertension occur in about up to 15% of patients, but can be found on echo in much more patients than that. And there's three patterns of pulmonary hypertension. There's the severe isolated pulmonary hypertension without significant fibrosis. And this occurs predominantly in patients with limited systemic sclerosis, okay? And this is usually later in their disease. So these are patients who may have a little Raynaud's, may have GERD, and may have some of the skin thickening and an anti-centromere antibody. And they're sort of slowly trickling along, and then eventually, you do the echo, you do the annual PFTs, and at some point later on in their disease process, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years, they start to have pulmonary hypertension. That's typically the story here, as opposed to the diffuse patients who will have the interstitial pulmonary fibrosis, and they may have pulmonary hypertension as secondary to that. And that's the second form. Do we need to evacuate? Okay. All right. Eric, it started because you came in late. Just kidding, sorry. I'll just keep going, and I'm sorry. If you can't hear me, I'll try to speak over the bell. So the third type reflects the combined vascular and fibrotic pathologic process of disease, and it results in a more indolent process. It's found in patients who have that slowly progressive pulmonary arterial hypertension, and then they have a secondary vascular component. Home free, okay. All right, so these are patients who, as you know, with pulmonary hypertension, the pulmonic component of the second heart sound may be accentuated, and eventually right-sided heart failure develops. They may have a decreased diffusing capacity relative to their FVC. This is what you're finding on these test results. So, for all of my scleroderma patients, whether it's diffuse or limited, they have annual echoes, they have annual PFTs, and at the very least a chest x-ray, and depending on their pulmonary quality, they often are getting chest CTs. And these are things that we're doing when we're initially diagnosing patients, because the course can be so indolent, it may not be noticed, and if you don't get to see the patients often enough, they may not actually tell you, oh yeah, every time I walk up a flight of stairs, I do notice I get shorter breath. So these are things that we do on a regular basis. So this is the lung infiltrate in the CAT scan. This is pretty severe fibrosis. That's okay. Just rip it open. So all these patients need to have, the influenza and strep pneumo vaccines. In persons with alveolitis, immunosuppressive drugs, cyclophosphamide and azathioprine may be effective. But I'll tell you that the discussion and the debate over whether or not these treatments are effective is ongoing. I just came back from the American College of Rheumatology annual meeting, and there was a big symposium called The Great Debate, Cytoxan in Pulmonary Lung Disease for Scleroderma. And, both physicians discussed the same exact data from two opposing viewpoints, one saying it was effective, one saying it was totally useless. So, you know, we definitely try it in our patients who have severe disease, in particular if they have the ground glass findings on their chest CT, but it's really not been proven to be the gold standard. In intrinsic pulmonary hypertension, intermittent and continuous IV prostacyclin analogs, which I'll go over with you a little bit later, and bosentan, endothelin 1 antagonists have been approved. Anticoagulation is often prescribed for patients with pulmonary hypertension, and you know, in very severe cases, they may need transplants. So renal, kidney involvement in systemic sclerosis may be manifested by scleroderma renal crisis or other involvement. The renal crisis used to be the most detrimental, the most severe complication in these patients, and that was prior to the development of ACE inhibitors. You know, whereas over the last 10 to 25 years, these medications have really dramatically improved the outcome. Although death and dialysis within 6 weeks were common before the advent of aggressive ACE inhibitor treatment, it's no longer usually required. Sometimes patients may be on temporary dialysis, but not that often. And clinically evident renal involvement is almost exclusive to patients with the diffuse case, especially those with the rapid progressive skin involvement. So renal crisis. Renal crisis develops in about 18% of patients. It's characterized by an abrupt onset of accelerated hypertension followed by oliguric renal failure. Patients may have headache, they may have blurred vision from hypertension, from retinopathy. They may also present with seizures, they may have acute dyspnea, and they may have sudden LV failure. More often than not, a patient will be known to have scleroderma before they present like this, but if they're really a patient who doesn't seek medical attention, who you know really has a little bit of Raynaud's, they really can be affected and end up in the ICU with this type of picture. They may have microscopic hematuria or low-grade proteinuria within several days or weeks, along with essentially like a rapidly progressing serum creatinine, oliguria, anuria. The patients who are at risk for developing renal crisis are patients who have diffuse skin disease. They may have a new or unexplained anemia. Patients who are on steroids are at risk of this, and we usually recommend no more than at the most 10 milligrams of prednisone a day for these patients, because anything above that, anything really above 7.5 a day, is really making them at risk. Pregnant patients or patients who have an anti-RNA polymerase 3 antibody are also at risk. And the patients who do worse are the males and patients who are older and whose creatinine is greater than 3. They may also have a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia with thrombocytopenia in this picture, and it's a pretty severe admission. There are non-renal crisis abnormalities in patients with scleroderma. They may have mild proteinuria, they may have a mild elevation in their creatinine, or hypertension in about half patients. Essentially, you know, you don't have to have a renal crisis to have scleroderma renal disease. Clinically evident disease is less common, but at autopsy, up to 80% of patients have been found to have some renal involvement. The treatment of renal crisis is, you know, early detection, most important therapy. So, you know, even the slightest headache and the slightest amount of hypertension really should prompt a renal assessment. Patients with early diffuse systemic sclerosis are advised to take their blood pressure often, and you know, if there's a big change, they need to seek medical attention. ACE inhibitors are the drugs of choice, but early aggressive therapy with other potent antihypertensives can also be effective. Like I said before, some patients may actually progress to require dialysis, and most can be maintained on ACE inhibitors, and the treatment for that can eventually, the dialysis can eventually be discontinued. And this is also a population of patients who may be candidates for a renal transplant. And I think the results are pretty similar to the population of other renal transplant candidates. Okay, so cardiac involvement. A friend of mine is an interventional cardiologist, a friend of mine from residency, and I was telling him I was doing this lecture for you, and he said, oh, I hate having those patients in the cath lab because, you know, their hearts are so hard. They have a lot of myocardial fibrosis. They're always really sick when they end up on the table. They may have LV or biventricular CHF. They may get myocarditis. You know, essentially all the same things that I've listed here, with the exception of the fibrosis, you can find in our other disease processes, right? But, you know, this is the important feature. They may also have acute symptomatic pericarditis, but that's not very common. And also these patients can have left-sided CHF secondary to fibrosis. They may have arrhythmias, they may have valvular disease, but usually not hemodynamically significant. And secondary cardiac disease occurs in association with pulmonary or renal disease, just like any other patient with pulmonary hypertension or renal insufficiency. You know, these are the patients who can also develop cardiac problems. The treatment is non-steroidals or low-dose steroids for symptomatic pericarditis. But I said again, you know, we try to keep these patients on less than 10 milligrams a day of prednisone if possible. If myocarditis is identified by biopsy, then high-dose steroids temporarily could be tried. DIG or diuretics often are the mainstay of therapy, just like any other patient with heart failure. Okay, so musculoskeletal manifestations. They can include muscle weakness. They may have anything from, you know, true arthritis to arthralgias. In diffuse systemic sclerosis, patients often start with a systemic polyarthralgia and joint stiffness. So it's really not as much pain as the rheumatoids and the lupus patients. It's really more stiffness. And again, like I mentioned earlier, they may have contractures from the process of fibrosis of the skin. Some patients may actually have palpable or audible friction rubs. I've never heard one, but somebody told me it's possible. And this is due to a fibrinous tenosynovitis. Okay? They may eventually develop severe arthritis or destructive joint disease if they have an overlap syndrome with RA. The two principal patterns of muscle involvement are myopathy related to scleroderma, which is usually pretty mild, relatively non-progressive, and the patients may have a slight elevation of CPK. But the other pattern, which is the scleroderma myositis, is essentially a real overlap between scleroderma and polymyositis. It's much less common, but the weakness is often very profound, and EMG and elevated CPK are very similar to what you would see in a pure inflammatory myopathy. There's also neurologic involvement, which can include cranial nerve abnormalities, peripheral nerve involvement, neuropathies. The central nervous system can also be involved, usually secondary to vascular issues. They may also have asymptomatic neuropathy, and at times they may have a threatening autonomic nervous system dysfunction. It's a pretty wide-ranging disease process. So what do we have to treat these patients with? The typical disease-modifying treatments, like I said, you know, are partially effective, but this is not a curable disease. And there's a lot of use of treatments targeting to the organ systems, like the GERD is treated with PPI, you know, the pulmonary fibrosis we attempt to treat with steroids or Cytoxan, but it's not usually very effective. And like I said, the cyclophosphamide, the NIH data in the scleroderma lung study from a few years back, and, you know, you can look, like I said, we just looked at the data from both sides of the perspective, and in some patients they did well, in others they just didn't do well at all. So it's really attempted but not expected to do very well. And the one thing I wanted to discuss was stem cell transplant, just because it's a little bit different compared to our other disease processes. And, you know, as you know, since 96, stem cell transplant has been used successfully for other disease processes and with a relatively low disease mortality. And there's been a fair amount of research into using stem cell transplant for scleroderma. Early results showed that stem cell transplant in carefully selected very sick patients and patients who have not had a lot of concurrent infections may be candidates for this. Okay. So just one more thing, just to go over inhibition of vascular damage. This is something that we're using a lot more of, and we work with the pulmonary people to try to get people these medications, whether in trials or through grants. The prostacycline analogs, the medications that are used to benefit exercise capacity, their dyspnea score, measuring cardiopulmonary hemodynamics. They come in inhaled forms. There's also bosentan, which we use. It's a mixed endothelin antagonist. This has been shown to both improve pulmonary hypertension and skin scores. So, you know, like I was saying, the treatments and those that we have up and coming have been somewhat effective, but still not curable. And this fibrosis, the ongoing fibrosis process, really awaits proven effective therapy. Okay, so I just wanted to end with a case report. The patient was a 65-year-old Korean female who came to the rheumatology clinic due to thickening of the hands and facial skin with pallor and cyanosis on cold exposure for 2 months. At our first visit, her blood pressure was normal, 130 over 80, just slightly elevated. On her exam, the only significant findings were skin thickening on the fingers of both hands and the right hand dorsum and right forearm. There was no cardiac abnormalities, no pulmonary abnormalities, and at that time she was diagnosed with limited systemic sclerosis based on the involvement of her skin and based on the fact that she didn't have any other manifestations of disease, okay? Her labs were essentially normal. Hemoglobin was a little bit low, but her SMA was normal and her creatinine was normal at this time. She had a positive ANA, but both the anti-centromere and the anti-SCL70 were negative. Her pulmonary function tests at the time were essentially normal. A high-res CT, which was done as part of the initial process, showed old tuberculosis in the right lower lobe with some pleural thickening and calcifications, but there was no evidence at that time of ILD. And she was started on treatment for Raynaud's and antihistamines for her skin itching. So just under 2 years later, after her diagnosis, the patient was noted to have a rapidly progressive course of skin thickening. It progressed to above the elbows and knees and finally involved the trunk. Her blood pressure was still normal, but at that time, you know, based on the fact that her skin disease really rapidly progressed and developed most and covered most of the rest of her extremities at that time, her diagnosis was changed from limited systemic sclerosis to diffuse cutaneous subset, and she was started on one of our older DMARDs, which is D-penicillamine. About a month later, she visited the ER due to facial edema and severe dyspnea. At that time, her blood pressure was over 200 over 130. She was tachycardic, and she was tachypneic, and her body temperature was 35. She reported that the dyspnea had begun 10 days previously and that her urine output had decreased markedly. So what do you think is happening?
Renal crisis.
Renal crisis, right. So even though I've told you for the most part, the patients who have just the skin findings don't usually progress to renal crisis. This is really a patient who actually had, a diffuse, a rapidly progressive course. Within the first couple of years of Raynaud's, she became symptomatic. Physical exam revealed facial and pre-tibial edema, and she had rales throughout her entire lung field. Her lab showed hemoglobin had decreased, LDH was increased to 700, her bilies were up, she had cysticites and polychromasia on her smear, suggesting hemolysis. Still, the ANCAs were negative, and then this time her UA showed proteinuria, hematuria, and pyuria as well. Her urine culture was negative. Azotemia was also detected with an elevated BUN and creatinine. And remember, her creatinine at presentation was 0.7, and now it's 2.2. On chest x-ray, she had cardiomegaly and bilateral hilar infiltrates consistent with edema. She was transferred to the ICU, intubated, and put on a vent. With the diagnosis of scleroderma renal crisis, captopril was begun, but it failed to reverse. She had such a severe deteriorating renal function, and the medication really just was unable to control her blood pressure. A renal biopsy at the time showed severe fibrinoid necrosis with luminal obliteration in the arteries and arterioles, strongly suggesting scleroderma renal crisis, as you would guess. The IF staining showed no evidence of immune complex or autoantibody deposition. And because of suspected renal crisis has been reported with these positive RNAP1 or 3 antibodies, like I mentioned to you before, she was tested for it and they were detected. Now, you know, this part is not obviously necessary to make a diagnosis or for treatment, but it's just something to remind you of that particular antibody. And the patient actually had to go on dialysis, and she's been continued on it for 3 years at the time when this was published without recovery. So it's a pretty rapid course. I mean, like I said, 2 years after her initial presentation, she developed all of the signs and symptoms of renal crisis. And this is just to show you the fibrinoid necrosis of her arterioles. Okay, so I know, you know, I went through a lot of pictures at the beginning, and, you know, I always give a lot of information, and it's mostly because this is a very complex and difficult disease to diagnose and to understand. And so, you know, hopefully you're able to take something away from it. I'm open to any questions. And if you have any questions about any patients that you see in clinic, please just call me anytime. Okay. Thanks. Any questions?